All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I'm the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and the brand new Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terrorism. And I've recorded more than 5,500 interviews since 2003, almost all on foreign policy, and all available for you at scotthorton.org. You can sign up for the podcast feed there, and the full interview archive is also available at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. Okay, guys, introducing Ken Bensinger from BuzzFeedNews.com, and man, he's got this incredible piece co-authored with Jessica Garrison called Watching the Watchmen. In fact, there's a couple of follow-up pieces too, and maybe prequel type ones. The Michigan kidnapping case is a major test for the Biden administration's commitment to fighting domestic terrorism and a crucible for the fierce ideological divisions pulling the country apart. Well, that's not the subhead I thought it would be. I thought it was going to say this whole thing was a giant FBI hoax is basically what the article's about. Welcome back, or welcome to the show. Sorry, not back to it. Nice to talk to you, Ken. How are you doing?
Nice to be here, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
What a great piece of work you have here. And I think we knew from the beginning, especially people who were watching with an eagle eye, that the magic word informant is going to come up here somewhere. And then the question is just how much they had to do with the thing. And what you have uncovered is, boy, did the informants, plural, have a lot to do with the plot that was revealed last October, right before the election, coincidentally, that the plot to kidnap and possibly, I guess, murder the governor of Michigan, Governor Whitmer there. So Whitmer, I guess I meant to say, sorry. Please, I guess, if you could take us through, you know, the most important names here and who's who and how it was that the plot began to come together. And I know it has to do with, you know, this militia group and these guys showing up at the Capitol building to protest previously and all of that. It was sort of the prelude to the later sort of entrapment story, I think, right?
Yeah, I think that's broadly it. I want to say that, you know, what in this piece, before I sort of go through the dramatis personae, I want to stress that we, that A, you may hear a barking dog occasionally, and I apologize, but also that we endeavored to sort of fact check, in a sense, the government's narrative about this case and find out what else is there beyond what the government is saying. And indeed, we did find out a lot, that there's a lot more to the story than what has necessarily shown up in court records. That said, I want to be clear that we are not trying to declare in this piece that this whole thing was a setup by the government, that this whole thing was a complicated government conspiracy. What we're saying is, here's what the government says. Here's what the defense is saying. Here's what we uncovered, and you, the audience, you, the readership, should look at this and make your own decisions about whether you think this was what the government says it is, or what the defense says it is, or whether there's some third truth. So I just think it's important to emphasize that we are not declaring officially in the story that this was that these guys got sort of targeted by the FBI, who concocted the entire thing. The kind of people we're talking about in this absolutely did have some pretty strong, pretty extreme ideas, pretty expressed violent thoughts, talked about things that I think are outside the norm of conversation before the feds ever got involved, right? These are people who are sharing memes in their militia group about, you know, killing cops and making jokes about getting, you know, explosives and burning up police stations and in their meetings talking about throwing Molotov cocktails into police officers' homes. And on top of that, and separately, expressing, you know, political ideas that I do believe are probably protected speech. You know, like, they didn't like the governor of Michigan. They expressed their frustration with her, and they said pretty nasty things about her, things that I wouldn't say about a elected official, but things that I do believe are protected speech. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they called her dirty names, and they sort of question her moral character and said all kinds of yucky things about her. But I think those things are protected. Mm-hmm.
Just to clarify here real quick, I see here again, I'm reminded at the top of your article, that you have documented, or through the government documents, you've confirmed that there are 12 different informants. And I think the ratio that got the headline was 12 out of 15 people involved in the plot. Is that correct? 12 out of 15?
No. So it is correct that there were 12 informants, and there may be more. We don't know. There's 12 informants that have been identified through discovery served up to the defense in the case, right? As to say, the evidence that the government has shared with the defendants, which at this date is not all the evidence, shows that there were at least 12 confidential human sources, which is what the FBI calls informants these days. Mm-hmm. There was at least 12 of those in some way connected to the case. Some of them were very deeply sort of embedded in the case, and some were a bit more peripheral. But there were about 12. That does not mean that 12 of the 15 people who were engaging in a conspiracy were in fact informants. There were 14 people ultimately arrested in the conspiracy between federal charges and state charges. There were 6 in federal court and 8 in state court. None of those people are informants. The government isn't in the business of arresting these informants. So those 14 people are not informants. There were separately 12 people who were, as I said, involved in the case in some way. So that it's a little bit more squishy in terms of what the ratio would be. But for example, in September, about less than a month, 3 weeks or so before they got arrested, a lot of these guys went on a nighttime surveillance run of Governor Whitmer's vacation home up in northern Michigan. By our calculations, of the 12 people who went on that, either 4 or 5 of them were either government informants or undercover FBI agents. So that's a significant number of the people who were on that trip. And just yesterday, new evidence came out showing that at a meeting that the government is considered to be very important in the history of this case in Ohio in June of 2020, there were at least 3 confidential informants in a room of about 15 people. So the government did have a significant number of eyeballs in almost every setting.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that, you know what, maybe I have a little confirmation bias from this because I've seen this kind of thing before, but isn't it the case that you tell in the story, if I have my names right, or if I did have them right as I was reading this thing and trying to understand it, that a lot of the worst provocation here came from the informants rather than, you know, in other words, they found some guys talking big on Facebook or whatever it was, and then they went and made a mountain out of the molehill. Or is that not right?
Well, I guess the easiest and most honest answer is that that's for the jury to decide, but that is certainly what the defense is saying. And they're suggesting that their evidence shows that. And we found, not just from the defense, but also from documents and interviews and conversations with people who knew the individuals involved through attorneys who were involved in the case, and also through people who were at some of the same meetings, that that there is certainly a way to look at this that is a very different version of events that the government doesn't want to talk about. So the government wants to cast in their charging documents that certain meetings, you know, were just basically a room full of people saying, yeah, let's kill this person, let's kill that congressman and that governor and that sort of thing. You talk to other people who were in the meeting, and they said that if indeed some of that conversation happened, the great majority of the conversation was peaceful and had nothing to do with that, and the government's leaving those facts out. So there's a real, you know, there's just a giant chasm between what one side is saying and what the other side is saying about what happened. And I'm not in the business of picking sides, but I do think there's certainly a lot of evidence to suggest that the government wanted to push things. And as an example, yesterday, this wasn't in the story either because it's new, but we found out yesterday that the main confidential informant in the case wasn't just sitting there sort of idly listening to what people were saying, but was indeed suggesting they do stuff. And we knew this when we wrote our article, that he was paying for transportation for people to make sure they got to events. He helped pay to fix someone's vehicle so they could go to things. Became the leader, the de facto leader of the group. He was elected the second in command of this group, the Wolverine Watchman. And then later the leader left, and so he was the de facto leader of the group, clearly had an influence in all these people's decisions. What we learned yesterday was that he actually asked or suggested to one of the defendants, probably the most notorious defendant, a man named Adam Fox, he suggested to him that he should consider shooting a bullet through Governor Whitner's house. He suggested to him that he explode a bomb outside her house or destroy her boat. So he actively was giving him ideas of violent acts to take against the governor. So that certainly militates in the direction of the government doing more than just sitting by and observing and reporting, but actually encouraging and pushing.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now let's go back, if we could, because you're right. I kind of jumped the gun the way I started here. But if we could go back to tell us a little bit of the most important who's who here. And for example, like this Wolverine Watchmen group, it's not the case that it was informants who set this whole thing up in the first place. These are the goofballs who were talking big, who got themselves investigated, basically. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there's no indication whatsoever that the government created the Wolverine Watchmen. The Wolverine Watchmen was founded by a guy named Joe Morrison in late 2019. Morrison lived with his wife and his kid and his father-in-law on a property in semi-rural Michigan. And he had a few minor run-ins with the law, nothing major, but he got busted for open carry of a sidearm inside his car. And he got it knocked down to a misdemeanor and I think served one day in jail or something. But it was just a few days after he took that plea that he founded the Watchmen, which existed as a training group to some extent, but also sort of an online community of these people, right? A lot of their activity was just on Facebook and on the Wire encrypted app, where they were talking to each other, sharing memes, and talking about their feelings, largely about cops, who they're mostly angry about. What galvanized the group was COVID-19, which pushed a lot of them in the direction of being very angry at the government and elected officials, particularly the governor of Whitmer, when she started doing stay-at-home orders, that sort of thing, and pushed them much farther towards wanting to sort of take some kind of concrete action or to show their discontent. And coincidentally or not, it was right around this time that a guy named who we know of as Dan, who became a confidential informant, comes across the group. And the story he tells is that he's an Army vet, an Iraq War veteran who is into guns and was searching Facebook for Second Amendment type groups and for groups where he could train with firearms. And the Facebook recommendation engine recommended the Watchmen to him. He went to check out their page, entered the group, passed through their vetting to the private group, and then passed through another round of vetting to get into their wire chat, where he almost immediately discovered them saying things like, "Let's go kill cops." And one of them suggested downloading an app to people's phones. It was like a hunting app, which I guess they could use to log the address of police officers and then make strategies to kill police officers. And Dan, the informant, testified to this later, but he was so scared about this, he went to a friend who was a cop. The cop referred to the FBI, and within a few days, he was meeting the FBI, showing his phone to them where they could see the contents of these chats. And they asked him if he would be willing to be an informant for them, and he said yes. And he continued to engage with the Watchmen and train with them. And, you know, it's interesting because from the government, the FBI's perspective, the training with them was all just part of him gaining confidence with the group so they could sort of honestly talk about their feelings. The defense says no. I mean, he knew more about training and knew about military tactics than all of them put together. And in a sense, he militarized them. He taught them things that they would never have learned otherwise and gave them capabilities that made them attractive to other militants and in general sort of made what was a minor threat at best into a much more serious threat.
Mm-hmm. Was he one of the guys who decided, hey, let's go bring our rifles to the Capitol building? And I'm not talking about January 6th. I mean the state Capitol building and wherever it was.
Lansing, Michigan.
Michigan, yeah. Sorry.
On April 30th, 2020, there was a big anti-mask, just sort of a political protest. It was a mixture of all the kind of things that were happening at that time. Now, this was before George Floyd, but there were certainly COVID feelings going on and a lot of other political things swirling in the air in spring of 2020. So they went to a protest there. And this was a lot of people in, you know, that would call themselves militants wearing tactical gear, a lot of them wearing Hawaiian shirts because they believed in the ideas of the Boogaloo. If some of your audience is familiar with that, if not, the Boogaloo is a sort of it's not an organization. It's kind of a belief system believing that the country is due for a massive violent overhaul, essentially a civil war to throw out old values and install, or sorry, throw out new values and get us closer to, you know, the values that the founders and the framers of the Constitution had. So people are wearing the Hawaiian shirts, they're carrying sidearms as well as long guns that with ammunition, which is legal to open carry in Michigan. And they're sort of protesting it outside the Capitol, and there starts to be rumors among the crowd that they want to storm the Capitol, right? This is the Capitol of Michigan. But in that circumstance, the Michigan State Police stood down and let them into the building. Interestingly, they did temperature checks for each of them to make sure they weren't sick with the virus, but they let them in with their weapons. So the building got filled up with these armed protesters throughout the whole building. And there's lots of photos from press who were there showing them, you know, throughout the building. It's a kind of an interesting sort of sneak preview of obviously what happened in January in Washington, D.C., with a slightly different outcome. So the Wolverine Watchmen were there, and Dan, the informant, was with them. He was wearing a wire and recording for the FBI at the time. And according to his testimony, he said that he, when he was outside the building and people were starting to rumor, to whisper about storming the Capitol, he quietly whispered into his mic or the device he was carrying, you know, these guys are serious, they might storm the Capitol. We don't know what impact that had, but it's quite possible that the stand down order that allowed the people in the building without resistance may have come as a result of Dan warning the government.
Mm-hmm. Hold on just one second. Be right back. So you're constantly buying things from Amazon.com. Well, that makes sense. They bring it right to your house. So what you do, though, is click through from the link in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org, and I'll get a little bit of a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. Won't cost you a thing. Nice little way to help support the show. Again, that's right there in the margin at scotthorton.org.
Hey, you want to know what industry is recession-proof? Yes, you're right. Of course, pot. Scott Horton here to tell you about Green Mill Supercritical Extractors. The SFE Pro and Super Producing Parallel Pro can be calibrated to produce all different types and qualities of cannabis crude oils for all different purposes. These extractors are the most important part of your cannabis oil business for precision, versatility, and efficiency. GreenMillSupercritical.com.
Hey y'all, Scott here. If you want a real education in history and economics, you should check out Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. Tom and a really great group of professors and experts have put together an entire education of everything they didn't teach you in school, but should have. Follow through from the link in the margin at scotthorton.org for Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom.
Yeah, all right. Well, and that could have turned out different ways, I guess, if they had been denied entrance, but seems like maybe that was actually, really a provocation too, to let them get that far instead of trying to stop them at the door, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know enough. It'd be interesting to see if someone could dive into the records and find out why the state police decided to let them in.
I think we have our friend Jason sue them under the Freedom of Information Act, right? And get those documents.
Yeah, if I worked for the Detroit newspaper, I would definitely want to know what that was all about. Is it a good, comparing January 6th to that, to April 30th in Michigan, is it a good idea to let people in? Is it a good idea to put up resistance? What's the best way to handle that kind of situation? And clearly the government, I think there's downsides to both, obviously, and the government hasn't figured that one out yet. Yeah.
If they have an informant inside the group, maybe they have him try to dissuade everyone else from doing that instead of being a big part of it all with them.
Right. I mean, to be fair, Scott, the watchmen were there, but there was probably only about 10 of them. And we're talking of a crowd of several hundred people. So it wasn't all watchmen, right?
That raises questions of how many other informants from other groups were there, too, though, right?
Yeah, right. We never know. I mean, there is a theory that some have that sort of particularly people in what they call themselves the Patriot Movement, people who are more politically conservative and many of whom identify as, some identify as Republicans, but more likely identify as libertarians. These people tend to believe that there's FBI agents behind every door. If you talk to FBI agents, especially retired ones, they'll say, no, that's like not true. There's not enough of us. And we need to have more. I guess that's obvious they would say that, but But I think there certainly is something in the FBI's game of wanting people to believe they're omnipresent and taking actions like this in part because they want to scare other people and make them think.
I mean, agents are one thing, but informants are another. And it's very easy for them to flip anybody by threatening them with decades in prison over, you know, receiving junk mail or whatever. They call that mail fraud, or telling somebody it's Tuesday and they call that lying to an FBI agent or whatever it is. And then they can extort pretty much anyone into becoming an informant. And you can have one agent can run how many informants? You know, it's not that hard.
You know, it's certainly true, but the
and then informants too oftentimes are bastards, right? And so they're making money and not having to have a job. Instead, all they got to do is get somebody else to say something stupid, which is pretty easy if that's your game, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think like there are informants, like you said, who are working off some problem, right? And they have a real incentive to find something, whether it's there or not. And I think that there's no question that the power of the federal government, of the federal law enforcement, FBI, the DOJ, and other agencies is massive, massive, massive. And the thing they can do, things that it can do to people's lives, the drop of a dime, is sometimes very terrifying. And one would think, sort of to quote Spider-Man, with great power comes great responsibility. And I think there's no question in my mind, in my experience of having covered federal law enforcement a fair amount over the years, that there are members of that community who take it very seriously and draw lines, and there's others who don't. And I tend to, and I don't know if you do it this way, but I tend to analyze things on a individual basis, meaning that we like to think of the FBI as a big monolithic organization that does everything of a single mind. But what I really see is a group of people with their own motivations that collectively create the actions of the FBI. And some people are motivated by personal ambition, and some are motivated by political ideology, and some are motivated by, you know, grudges they want to settle, and all these different things. And when you look at it from the outside, it just seems like this is what the FBI is doing, right? But in the end, it's because, you know, maybe the informant, for example, is motivated by wanting to work off a problem, or because they have some ideological issue, or because they're a true believer and they think they're saving the planet. In the end, those kind of personal motivations can lead to very dramatic impacts on other people's lives.
Yeah.
Had the opportunity.
Go ahead.
To watch. I just had the opportunity to watch a movie that I thought was. It's not. I don't think it's very well known in this country for some reason. It's a British filmmaker, but it's an American movie that I think your audience might really enjoy. It's called The Day Shall Come, and I have no connection to it, so I'm not benefiting from this endorsement. But I think it's tremendous. It's a fictional movie, but it says at the beginning, based on hundreds of true stories, and it's about the FBI in Miami trying to basically bust terrorists, and they target this one group of sort of kind of kooky religious fundamentalists, like this like small enclave of like
the Liberty City Seven. You're talking about.
Well, I think it's based on that. I think it's clearly based on that, but this is like a fictionalized version. Right. Uh-huh. And boy, like it's the perfect example of like a black comedy that you're laughing and laughing until you're suddenly not laughing anymore.
Yeah.
I really recommend it.
And there's so many of those. And Trevor Aronson, of course, is the boss of it and wrote the book on it. But, you know, they're just from the Bush years through the Obama years. And I guess I lost track at some point, but, you know, I know Trevor says there have been more than 300 of these cases that are, you know, somewhat at least pretty questionable about how much of a real plot ever existed here before the informant themselves took the initiative. And then some of them are just absolute outrages, like Liberty City 7 and Hamid Hayat and the Fort Dix pizza plot and some of these others that are just complete put-ons. And so I guess that's really the bottom line here. And I know we're, you know, running out of time, but I guess the question for you is, and I know that you're a hard reporter on this and you can't do too much opinioning or whatever, but does it look to you that without these informants, all of this stuff about scoping out the governor's house and plotting to blow up bridges and all of these things that these guys are now being indicted and prosecuted for would not have really happened?
I mean, it's very hard to sort of imagine a version of this narrative that exists when the multiple informants aren't there to sort of help put pieces together. We only talked about the Wolverine Watchmen, but there was other groups of people. Three percenters were heavily involved in this case. For example, you have different groups of people with lots of strong and potentially violent feelings, but they're not together. They don't know each other. They're not talking to each other. And if nothing else, the government played a role in making sure that they knew each other and spent time together. I mean, the government went to great lengths to ensure that happens. And so the question is, you know, would these people have taken any kind of violence if they hadn't been sort of put into the same, you know, the same room, and those conditions hadn't been made by the government? And, you know, I'm very sympathetic to those who would say that seems impossible. Without the government putting them together, they never would have made that plot. And I think that is not unreasonable. The flip side is that, you know, these people did. It's too simple to say these people were just sort of like regular citizens who were randomly targeted. These are people who were expressing pretty extreme thoughts. You know, Adam Fox, who was one of the main defendants in the federal case, the first time he gets on the phone with the informant, sort of unprovoked, without like really no provocation, just sort of like what the informant says, what are you interested in doing? What do you want to do? And he says, I want to storm the Capitol. I want to barricade the doors of the Capitol. This is Michigan Capitol, not the federal. During their legislative session, and then I want to execute every single lawmaker on TV one by one. And if that doesn't work, I want to burn down the building with all of them in it. And meanwhile, I want to grab the governor, hog tie her, put her on a table and just spread her out like a DEA trophy, you know, the way they spread sort of drugs and money they see from drug dealers. It's like, I want to spread her out on the table for everyone to look at. He said all that unprovoked. That wasn't like the agent being like, hey, would you like to do this? The governor, the informant just said, hey, what are you interested in? And that's what he said. I don't think that's the kind of normal fantasies that most people have in this country. It certainly is not my experience. So the question is, what is a guy like that, Adam Fox, who harbors those kind of ideas, what becomes of him if he's not put in the room with other people with similar ideas? And that, I don't know. We don't know.
Yeah. But in this case, he's saying all this to a guy whose job is essentially to figure out how to make it look like this guy's dangerous.
Yes, but I mean, that's right. He's supposed to make this guy look like he's dangerous. And the flip side, like, you know, it's complicated. Are we allowed in this society to have those thoughts? I think we are in the First Amendment. That said, you know, if this guy, I mean, let's look at the flip side. Let's say this guy, Adam Fox, has these ideas and he does something on his own anyway, without the FBI ever getting involved. And he goes and he like blows up the governor's house or kills some lawmaker or kills a cop. I mean, then the question is going to be, where was the FBI? How could they have failed so badly on this, right? Then there would have been massive public attention about what a failure this was and how much they screwed up. I'm not crying for the FBI. I'm not sympathetic for them, but they are in this position where they definitely are damned either way. I mean, they always, like, if they go too far, which they often do, they rightly get lambasted in public for going too far. If they fall asleep at their post, which also happens too often, then they're you know, critiqued for not being on top of things. So I think that's, you know, boo-hoo-hoo for the FBI, I get it. But, like, that's one of the difficulties of the task they're assigned. Mm-hmm.
And now, how many total people have been indicted in this thing?
In federal court, 6 people. In state court, 8 people.
Mm-hmm. And why the discrepancy there?
I hesitated there, by the way, because it's a boring technical point. But in state court, they weren't indicted. They were charged, and then there was no grand jury, because in most state cases in Michigan, there is no grand jury. It was just what's called bound over to district court. So essentially, judge served as the grand jury and determined that the charges were legitimate and could move towards trial.
Gotcha.
Why were 6 indicted in federal court and why were 8 charged in state court? The federal ones were charged with conspiracy, kidnapping conspiracy, and then later with conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction and a couple firearm charges. The state charges were for people who seem to be a little less involved in what the government says was the kidnapping plot. So they're being charged under Michigan's anti-terrorism law, which, among other things, they're being charged with aiding and abetting, providing material support to terrorism.
Right.
Because they trained with them and spent time with them, they're being charged with a crime under that.
Yep. All right. Listen, I know you got to go. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it, Ken.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for the good questions.
All right, you guys. That is Ken Bensinger with Jessica Garrison here at BuzzFeedNews.com watching The Watchmen. It's worth all 10,000 words here. Believe me.
The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A. APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.